from WNYC New York Public Radio. This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. This is just one segment of the program. You can hear all Leonard's interviews on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
It would be an understatement to call Roger Corman one of Hollywood's most prolific filmmakers. By 1970, he'd completed some 45 films as producer-director, and so far the number of films he has produced alone is well over 550. His influence on the industry far exceeds his own output. More recently, he has written the introduction to something called the Chamberlain Brothers International Student Film Festival, a paperback that comes with its own DVD. And there's a festival of the films from the book taking place today and tomorrow at the Tribeca Cinemas. Well, here to tell us more and to reminisce about his own amazing career is none other than Roger Corman. Welcome back to the show.
Happy to be back, Leonard.
How on earth did you get involved in this festival?
The festival organizers, the Chamberlain Brothers, called me and simply stated that they were starting a new international student film festival, and would I cooperate and work with them? And I said I would be happy to, because I like very much the opportunity to work with new filmmakers.
You have all your career, but many of them had not gone to film school.
That's true. It's called the Student Film Festival, and a number of them are indeed formal film school participants or graduates. Others have come up through the ranks, so I guess the word student could be loosely applied.
But there are a lot of film schools these days, and when you came along, I'm not sure there was even one.
There were three film schools when I started in the 1950s. They are still probably the three preeminent schools, SC and UCLA in Los Angeles, and New York University Film School here in New York.
In fact, a lot of people got their starts with you who came out of that. But film school is not like other school. You go to law school or med school or get a business degree, and you're pretty much assured that you're going to have a career if you're at all competent. But film school simply assures that you're going to have a lot of student loans to pay off later.
That is one problem with film schools. As you say, you go to law school, you'll probably become a lawyer, the same with for medical school. The problem is there are so few opportunities in motion pictures or television. However, there are other opportunities working in commercials, music videos, documentaries, and so forth. But still, it's true, the majority of film school graduates will not work in films.
So what is even the value of going to film school?
The value of going to film school is, let me see, I would put it roughly equivalent to the value of going to the California gold fields after 1849. You might strike it rich.
But then again, your beginnings are so unusual. There have been numerous films about the guy in the mailroom or the messenger boy who makes it to the top, but very few real cases of it.
That's true. I was in the messenger corps, as it were, at 20th Century Fox, and I think I'm the only one. I haven't really stayed in touch that much with the other guys, but I think I'm the only one who's come at least some distance out of the mailroom.
Did they spot you as something, someone with talent? You became a story analyst at Fox after that.
Story analyst is a very nice way to say reader.
Who gets all of the stuff to read that nobody else wants to read.
Exactly. It isn't that they spotted me particularly. It's that I went out of my way to get their attention. At that time, the studios were working in production 6 days a week, but the office workers were working 5 days a week, and I offered to work for nothing on the sixth day, on Saturday, if I could be carrying messages to and from the set. So they believed I was a good, hard worker, and I became known a little bit, and they had an opening for a new young reader in the story department, and they gave it to me.
Did that help at all?
It did help.
It taught you how to write scripts, I suspect.
Yes, and since as the youngest guy in the department, I got the worst of the scripts, and I learned probably as much from the bad scripts as from the good ones.
I'm sure, and I suspect that you came across a couple of good ones and hoped that they'd be made, and only to discover that somebody further up got rid of them.
Yes, I only recommended a couple. I was there for about a year. I only recommended a couple of them. One, a Western I really liked. It was called The Big Gun, and I wrote extensive notes on that, and they bought it. They changed the title to The Gunfighter,
which Gregory Peck.
With Gregory Peck, and somehow somebody higher up on the line got credit for giving notes, and I left Fox.
Robert Wise directed that, didn't he?
I don't remember who directed it.
But see, you left Fox, and you could have gone to film school even then, because as you say, there were three, but you didn't.
I knew so little about it. I'd had a degree in engineering from Stanford. If I'd known there were film schools, I would have gone. I didn't even know there were, and I wanted to go to Europe, so I went to Oxford on the GI Bill and studied English literature.
But still wanted to be in the movies.
Yes.
Wound up producing first. Now, how do you start producing from scratch when you know so little?
I wrote a script and sold it to a small independent producer. And just as I volunteered to work for nothing for the extra day at Fox, I said, as part of the sale of the script, I want to work for nothing as associate producer and get credit as associate producer. The actual producer saw nothing wrong with that. But what happened, it enabled me to say that I was a writer-producer, and I had the official credit to do it. So that started me off.
When you look at the work of the kids involved in the Chamberlain Brothers International Student Film Festival, you have to wonder whether they have gone through some of the things you did just to get into the movie business.
I talked with them the other night at dinner and last night at the opening of the festival, and they pretty much have. One of the things that they use, which is very good, the ones who've gone to film school, I should say, I think in a film school you learn a number of things. One, you learn the technique of making films from your classes and your professors. The other thing is you learn from just the interchange with the other students, the talking, the gossiping, the theoretical discussions, and also you're able to work together. And I've seen this happen a number of times. A group of people will get together led by one person who will be the producer or the director, and everybody will have a share of the film, and they will get equipment or they'll take it out of the film school vaults, and they can make a picture independently.
Although they also are working kind of by the old auteur theory. You usually have a director who also wrote the thing, may even edit it, and so it represents a certain person's vision. When you got started, you were part of the studio system. It was normal for someone to write a script and then see a movie that had little resemblance to what they did.
Yes, that still exists for, I would say, most pictures in Hollywood, in that the positions of producer, director, and writer are clearly defined. However, more and more you're beginning to see writer-directors, writer-producers, and television, of course, the writer-producer is really the key man.
A point was made that Clint Eastwood did not change one word of Paul Haggis's script for Million Dollar Baby. The point is made because that practically never happens.
That's true. Generally, a director will come in and his vision hopefully will be close to the vision of the writer, but it's always going to be a little bit different, and you'll make some shading.
So what happened with your first script?
My first script was heavily changed, and I felt that was the end of my career, that they had ruined my script. In retrospect, I simply didn't know that scripts were changed that much during production.
But that you write in the introduction to this book that it would that a would-be director, if one came to you today with credentials like yours, when you made your first movie, there's no way you would hire him. So that's not all that encouraging either.
That's right, because I had no credentials to speak of. Today, however, you have more of an opportunity to get credentials. When I came in, it was in the late 1950s. Television was just starting, was not a meaningful place to get credentials. If you didn't go to a film school, you really had no credentials, so you had to work your way up. But today, in my position, I would have gone to a film school, have a graduate thesis film, or if not, I would have been working in commercials or music videos or something and have some sort of credentials.
Well, you've discovered an awful lot of top directors. The list, which we'll probably go over a little later, is astounding. And half of them went to film school and half of them didn't. And I don't see much difference, finally, in the quality of their work. It comes down to the fact that these are amazingly talented people.
That's true. In the long run, it's the talent of the person. At the beginning, going to film school gives you a little bit of an advantage. But just working on a set, even if you're, what would I say, if you're sweeping the floor.
Which I'm sure you also did on those days.
You're learning something there. If you're alert, you are sweeping the floor, and you're also looking and seeing what is the director doing, what is the cameraman doing, what are the grips and electricians doing.
So how did you wind up getting the money together for your first films? And how much did they cost?
My first film, Monster from the Ocean Floor, I actually called it, it stalked the ocean floor, and when I sold it to a distributor, he thought that title was too arty, and he changed it to Monster from the Ocean Floor, cost $12,000 in cash. I'd sold my script for $6,000, so I had $6,000, and I borrowed money from various friends of mine, mostly guys I'd gone to college with, to get the other $6,000. I had deferments. The Consolidated Lab, and I'll always remember Sid Solo, who was the president of the lab, gave me a complete deferment on the lab work.
And sometimes we hear similar stories today, although nobody can make a film for anything like that, or even with inflation counted in like that, despite the fact that equipment is a lot cheaper today than it was then.
That's true. My $12,000 with the deferments came to a little bit over $30,000. With inflation, that would be a little bit over, I don't know, about somewhere between $100,000 and $120,000, $130,000. It would be very, very difficult today. But I was the writer-producer. I took no salary as such. The director took no salary because he wanted the credit, and we divided up the profits and so forth.
Well, did you have any heroes at the time? Were you trying to make films like other filmmakers?
I had no particular heroes. I liked the film noir style, and that was the first script I sold was in the film noir style. I always liked science fiction, and the first film I wrote and produced was a science fiction film. It was only later when I began to learn more about films that I began to identify with and learn from watching the films of certain directors and certain producers.
My guest is Roger Corman, who is one of Hollywood's greatest producer directors and discoverers of talent, and he's written the introduction to a book called Chamberlain Brothers International Student Film Festival, which is complete with a DVD of the films. There's also a screening of most of those films open to the public today and tomorrow at Tribeca Cinemas, 54 Varick Street. For more information, you can email them at cbfilmfest@tribecacinemas.com. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Roger Corman. He's written the introduction for Chamberlain Brothers International Student Film Festival with a DVD. I guess we're seeing more and more books with accompanying DVDs. In this case, the films of the students who are talked about in this book. Is that what the DVD is?
Yes. To me, this is something very new, and I think it's a great idea that they came up with to have the book of the films, describing the films, an introduction by me, and the book actually was written by Kimberly Brown, who did a very nice job. And at the back is a small CD, and I had not seen that before. And I talked to Carlo and Ron, who were organizing it, and I said, this is such an obvious and good idea. It's one of those things you think, why didn't we all think of it, but you guys thought of it?
Well, when you were discovering new talent, what was the basis for hiring them? For example, Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, Jack Hill, Monty Hellman, Amy Holden Jones, they all went to film school. So yes. Did they bring you student films?
The first one of that group I hired was Francis Coppola, and I saw some student work he'd done at UCLA, and I had bought two Russian science fiction films, which were wonderful films from a special effects standpoint. On the other hand, they were filled with the most outrageous anti-American propaganda you could imagine. So I had called UCLA, and I said, who in your graduating class would be your best editors? And they sent me the work, I think, of three students. They were all very good. And I thought Francis's work was the best. So I hired him simply to re-edit these Russian films, get the anti-American propaganda out. And he then became my assistant and shot second unit for me. And after that, he directed his first film for me.
And the same sort of thing with Martin Scorsese. I'm sure the first time you saw anything by him, you knew that he was a special talent.
Marty had gone on a little farther. He had come out of the NYU film school, and he'd made, I've forgotten the title of it, a black and white film, more than a student film, but not quite a commercial
film.
Was
that Knocking on Any Door or Mean Streets?
No, it was Who's That Knocking on My Door might have been the title. And I liked that very much. Almost all of the other people you mentioned had worked for me as an assistant. But I thought Marty's work was so good, and I was looking for somebody to direct the sequel to a picture I had directed, but I didn't want to direct the sequel. So I hired Marty simply on the basis of looking at the film.
Some of the others that you have discovered, or if we can call it discovered, after all, they were already there, didn't go to film school, and they have had amazing careers. Peter Bogdanovich, Jonathan Demme, Ron Howard, everybody knew him as an actor, Joe Dante, James Cameron, John Sayles. It's extraordinary. Just because you like these guys, were they all just assistants at one point?
Most of them had worked for me as an assistant. For instance, Joe Dante would be an example. He started as an assistant editor, moved up to trailer editor, then moved up to feature film director editor, then moved up to second unit director, and finally became a director. Now, that's a lot of jobs, but the whole thing was accomplished in about a year and a half or something. And that, to me, is an ideal way to work with somebody. So they learn something of the way I and my company work, and I learn something about them, and it's a natural progression up.
So they would do second unit directing, and
yes.
If they failed, you'd say, that's the end of that. This guy doesn't get another chance.
Pretty much. He may get another chance, but it won't be with me.
On the other hand, you were taking some incredible leaps of faith, weren't you?
I was.
I mean, not that you were throwing around big bucks. They all joke about how tight you were with dollars.
As a matter of fact, Ron Howard did his first picture, Grand Theft Auto, for me. And when he did, I think, Apollo 13, a number of these directors have cast me as characters in their pictures. He cast me as the senator who was worried about the cost of the space program.
Typecasting. You've also found some pretty amazing actors along the way. Jack Nicholson and Peter Fonda both in one movie. Well, Jack Nicholson had worked for you on other things before.
Jack had worked with me as a writer and as an actor. And on The Trip, my 1960s picture about LSD, Peter played the lead and Jack wrote the script.
And Dennis Hopper is also one of your people. Did you just have a good eye for talent in that way, or were these just guys who were willing to work for very little money and turned out to be pretty good?
No, it wasn't a matter of money, because I've always been signed with the Screen Actors Guild. So I'm always paying at least Screen Actors Guild scale, and for leads I would pay over. So I would be paying the going rate there for low-budget pictures. It was a matter of simply working with the actors, sometimes seeing them on stage. Bruce Dern I saw on stage in New York and cast. Or sometimes Jack Nicholson was in an acting school I attended. I felt to be a better director, I should learn more about acting. So I would meet them in various ways, meet a number of people and say, this person seems right.
You have When you go over the list of films that you've done, some of them are those outrageous titled films like The Viking Women and the Sea Serpent, or The She Gods of Shark Reef. But then there also are Little Shop of Horrors, which went on to have an incredible life of its own. Were they all the same for you? Was it all a matter of just playing with genres?
It was playing with genres. It still is. But it's sometimes stepping away from genres and sometimes, if not always, trying to expand the rules, if there are rules, the vague rules of the genre, to at least bring something new or original to each picture if you can.
In those days, there was a ready market for these kinds of films, because they were shown as the bottom halves of double bills, or they were very popular in drive-ins. Do you think that those kinds of films are still being made today, or is there an audience out there that's hungry for something that's not being provided?
The audience is still there. Unfortunately, it's not so much in theaters. When I first started, I could take a $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 film and play it in theaters and do well. Today, the majors dominate theatrical exhibition to such an extent that most of these films are forced to open either on cable networks or on DVD. So there's still a market for the films, but unfortunately, it's not theatrical.
And then when they make films of the sort, like The Fast and the Furious, they make them big budgets and big studios with big stars. You found a way to do them with people who might go on to be stars or were very respectable actors. Looking at some of the casts you've had over the years, none of them were superstars at the time you used them, but quite a few of them have had wonderful careers.
Yes, Charlie Bronson, I remember, played his first lead for me as Machine Gun Kelly. Sylvester Stallone played his first lead in Death Race 2000.
On the other hand, you had Boris Karloff at the end of his career, and you did a lot of movies with him, and with Vincent Price as well.
Vincent Price particularly was a solid, established actor with a name. He had been a leading man in his youth, had grown into a very good character actor, and Vincent and I did, I think, 6 or 7 pictures together.
My guest is Roger Corman, who is one of the greatest independents in the history of film. He's also written the introduction for Chamberlain Brothers International Student Film Festival, a book written by Kimberly Brown, which includes a DVD with 6 new films from 6 of the hottest young directors. It is published by Chamberlain Brothers, which is a member of the Penguin Group. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Those films that you did with Vincent Price from the Edgar Allan Poe stories brought you international acclaim. Was that a surprise that they took off to the point where you were honored with a retrospective by the French Film Institute, the youngest producer, director ever to have that happen?
It was a little bit of a surprise. The French New Wave critics were the first ones to recognize something going on in my films. And I never really planned to do a series of Edgar Allan Poe pictures. I really just wanted to do The Fall of the House of Usher. But it was successful, and I did, I think, 6 of them, and then finally moved away and said it's time to do something else. But I think there's a little bit of lesson there for the young directors, such as the ones in the Chamberlain Brothers Film School, Film festival. Most of them, as I said, are film school graduates. You can get started in any number of ways. You get a little recognition. It builds upon itself. And then you can move into other areas. And I was talking with a number of them, as I say, at the Chamberlain Brothers Film Festival, and they all have their individual voices. Each one of those six films was very well made, and it demonstrated different abilities and different thought processes. I was very pleased with the quality.
But what happens usually is that young filmmakers make serious films, or funny films, but films that rely more on just talent, and then when they wind up in the film business these days, it's all about putting together computer-generated images, isn't it? Something that they can't be prepared for.
That's true. The biggest budget films today are heavily computer-animated.
Did you wish you had more of that available to you when you were making some of those underwater sea serpent kinds of movies?
Yes, because the work is much better. Technically, the films being made today are the best that have ever been made. The worry, however, I don't know if worry is the right word, the problem is that very often the director or the producer or possibly even the writer becomes dependent upon the special effects and the story, the narrative suffers. I think you must be careful that you do emphasize you are telling a story and the special effects help the story, not the other way around.
The review today of Sin City made that point. Not everyone will agree, but she said as long as the action scenes were great, but then when we got into the people, they were drained of any humanity, and she found herself falling asleep.
That can happen. I've semi-experienced that myself on watching some of these bigger budget films. Yet at the same time, for the young filmmakers, a little bit of an opening is being created. The audience en masse clearly goes to these big films. Yet at the same time, there's a niche audience being separated out that would prefer to see it doesn't have to be independent. I started to say independent. It could be a major studio, but generally an independent film that is more dependent upon the story, upon the characterization, less dependent on big stars or big special effects.
Well, the Academy Awards revealed that this year, where Sideways and Million Dollar Baby were major contenders, didn't have any special effects. But if you don't have the money for special effects, it does force you also to come up with clever solutions, and sometimes will encourage more creativity.
I really believe in what you said. I think a problem can be solved, for instance, very easily by saying, okay, we'll do something phenomenal with special effects. But if you don't have that money, you may solve it in a more interesting way by simply telling your story.
Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm sure that you had to do with any number of those movies. Should I bring out some more of those titles? I just love some of them. In fact, the titles probably were a key to them, weren't they? They told people just what the movie was like. Teenage Caveman, for
now,
example.
Teenage Caveman.
A Bucket of Blood.
Okay, Teenage Caveman I want to come back to. I never made a picture called Teenage Caveman. I made a picture called Prehistoric World. And after it was made, American International had just come out with a picture called I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. So they changed the title to Teenage Caveman. After it got startlingly good reviews. And I said to them, you guys are really underselling the picture. I think we should go back to Prehistoric World. So they did go back to Prehistoric World, but the title Teenage Caveman stays.
Yet it was the kind of title that you could publicize, just like you could publicize Attack of the Crab Monsters.
Exactly.
And that was part of the success of some of these films. The titles were easily publicized.
Yes. If you didn't have star names, you were dependent really upon your title and your artwork to bring the audience in for at least the first week.
At one point, your company, New World Pictures, was the largest independent motion picture company in the United States. So why did you sell it?
Very simple reason. Three Hollywood lawyers offered me more money than I thought the company was worth. So I sold the company and started a new one.
And you can always make movies with the new money.
Right.
Tell us a bit about some of the filmmakers in the Chamberlain Brothers collection. Are there some that you feel if you were still doing this sort of thing, you would hire to save an old Russian film that was too anti-American?
There were several. I'll go by the names of the pictures because I get confused as to who did which one. Zeke was a very interesting and good black comedy. Toxin was in the tradition of film noir and was very well made. Surprisingly enough, there were a number of comedies, which there aren't so many of. The Plunge, The Reunion, and The Perils of Nude Modeling, which was a funny title. It could have been called The Joys of Nude Modeling, which was very funny. I think all of those were very good.
Well, let me give the filmmakers involved. There is one more, Enlightenment.
Enlightenment, I would mention, it was done by a Thai director. It was a very good film, but since the director lives in Thailand, there's little chance I'm going to be hired.
That was Tenon Satarujewong. But Scott Rice did Perils and Nude Modeling, Todd Shulman, The Plunge, Ben Epstein, The Reunion, Chris Fulkins, Toxin, and Dana Bunning, Zeke. You remember them all. That was very impressive. And the book we are talking about is the Chamberlain Brothers International Student Film Festival. It's not just a book. It actually includes the six films that are discussed in the book by six of the hottest young directors. The book is written by Kimberly Brown, who interviews the filmmakers, and it has an introduction by Roger Corman, who is one of the greatest filmmakers. I think at this point we can say that, can't we?
Still living.
still
living at my
Just one
age.
More thing. Fantastic Four, a movie's coming out. You were going to do a Fantastic Four. What happened?
The Fantastic Four, the story of the production of it, is one of the weirdest stories I've ever been connected with.
You have to tell it in a minute.
Okay, in 1 minute, a number of years ago, Bert Eichinger, a German producer, had the rights to the film had the rights to make the film, and he came to me and said he was going to make a big-budget film, but he didn't have the money. But to maintain his option, could I make a low-budget version for $1 million? And I made it, I produced it, and we shot it at our studio for $1 million, and he had an option. If he could sell it to a major studio, he would and give me a share of the profits, or my company could release it. He sold it to 20th Century Fox. The big-budget version is coming out, and I asked Bernd what he's going to do with our low-budget version. He said, I will release the low-budget version after the big-budget version as the prequel, and I'll probably make more money.
And that sounds like a Roger Corman-type story. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.
By the way, if you want to know more about the films being shown at the Tribeca Cinemas today and tomorrow, you can send an email to cbfilmfest@trbecacinemas.com. Or you can buy a book, the book we're talking about, complete with the DVD.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.